The show of support from you, our valued listeners, has been overwhelming. You've already raised enough to pay for the production of most of this year's episodes. If you can afford a little something, please click the link to the GoFundMe in the show description. Thank you so very much. Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes Joel Selvin and John Johnson to discuss The Twist, The Mob, and The Peppermint Lounge. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by Joel Selvin and John Johnson Jr. to discuss the book, The Peppermint Twist, The Mob, The Music, and the Most Famous Dance Club of the 1960s. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good to be back, Nate.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to have you back. And Joel, this book's a little different. I've talked to you several times, and they've always been solo works. How come you needed a collaborator on this one, and how did you and John divide the work?
So John Johnson and I were college roommates, and he went on to become a rather distinguished journalist while I ended up being a rock critic in San Francisco. And he was in the Washington Bureau for the McClatchy chain, and then he was a big shot crime reporter at the LA Times for many years. He covered the Menendez case. Got a book and a movie out of that. So this book, it was way above my pay grade. It flopped into my hands through my agent. I think it was my agent, wasn't it, Frank? Johnny, I can't remember, but somebody came to us with this deal. It came to me with this deal, and I said, aha, this is time to contact John Johnson. So really, you know, it's a crime story and with music elements, and I'm responsible for the music elements, and John wrote the book. How's that?
That makes sense. John, so can you tell us about the third co-author on the book, or with Dick Cammey? Who's Dick Cammey, and why was he worth building a book around?
Did you read the book?
I did.
So you know who Dick Cammey is. He's the first person of the narrative. He's the son-in-law of a mobster who owned a nothing bar down off Times Square, and wanted to turn it, and Dick Cammey wanted to book rock and roll bands, and that's the sort of the origin of the Peppermint Lounge. But Johnny is up on the gangster story. I can't even at this point remember Dick's father-in-law's name, Johnny.
It was Johnny Biello, yeah.
Right, yeah.
And, yeah, although he later in life, he went by BLE because he was trying to get out of the mob and be respectable, like, the cliched, mobster often does. And but his real name was BLO, and his nickname was Futo because supposedly he had won this nickname by stomping a black hand to death who was leaning on one of the merchants his mother shopped with and was about to close because the black hands were taking his money. So that's how he got the nickname.
Yeah, and the black hand was the precursor of the what we think of as the modern Italian mafia. They essentially were mostly guys right off the boat from Sicily and Napoli and other places, just doing straight up extortion. They were called the Black Hand because they would send out mailers and flyers with black hand and ink printed at the bottom. And you knew if you got one of those, you were going to be paying some taxes to somebody who wasn't in the government. But who was Dick Cammey, and what was his relationship with Futo Biello?
John? Well, he was, he was married to Johnny's daughter, Joni, and they met, I think, at a New Year's Eve party. And Joni had a constant, I mean, Joni knew who her dad was, but she had a common thing, way to answer questions about it. And when a teacher would, she went to private schools and all the pampered kind of Italian princess kind of growing up. When somebody would say, "What does your dad do?" she would say, "He makes books." And the teacher would say, "You mean like a publisher?" And she would say something like that. So anyway, Dick was introduced to her, and they fell for each other. But Dick fell just as hard, in a way, for her, his future father-in-law, because he really respected him and liked him. So that's how they got to know each other.
And as mafia buffs know, there's the New York Mafia has organized itself into five what they call families. Which family was Futo in?
He was, the family was originally Lucky Luciano, who was the guy who I think originally divided the five into five families. And when Lucky Luciano was sent away and eventually, banned from the country, Frank Costello took over. And Johnny became very close with Frank Costello. Costello was known as the diplomat of the mob, who basically tried to settle things without violence and wanted to see the mob as a business entity as much as a crime family. So anyway, that Johnny was working under Frank Costello, and in fact became one of his chief capos. And at one time, the FBI believed that Johnny would take over after Frank Costello retired or was retired, the way those things worked.
But something happened to Frank Costello in 1957, and somebody else took over. What's the quick story there?
The Mayflower Hotel.
Yep.
You're talking about the attempted assassination of him.
I am.
Jim Gigante and Tommy Eboli were the. He was the wheelman, and Gigante was the gunman. But he was he attacked Costello in the lobby of his apartment building, and didn't kill him. Bad shot. But Costello took the message and retired and died in his sleep in his bed.
And that's why we call this the Genovese family. Modern days, because a very, very deeply unpleasant man named Vito Genovese took over. But let's hear our first song. This is "The Twist" by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, a B-side from 1958. And that was the original version of "The Twist" by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, a B-side for an R&B charting single in 1958. So not quite the social phenomenon yet that we're about to deal with. But before we get into that, how was it that Futo Biello and his son-in-law, Dick Cammey, came to own and run the Peppermint Lounge? And what were their ambitions for that club, John?
Well, what happened was one of Johnny's associates went on the lam, as they put it, and he asked Johnny if he would take over his bar. And the bar had originally been a gay bar that served sailors, and and Johnny came in, and you know, he owned several other bars, including one called the Wagon Wheel, which is a couple blocks away. And so at one point, you know, they decided, well, we're gonna, you know, have to run this bar. How do we run it? And Johnny told Dick, who had Dick's father was actually a very well-known voice teacher, and so Dick had a little record company at one time, and he proved not to be a very successful record company executive, passing on Dion and the Belmonts' first hit, I Wonder Why. And he also didn't like a song called Happy, Happy Birthday Baby, which also went on to become a hit. So anyway, because of taking over this club or this bar, Johnny said, well, Dick, you know, I'll give you a chance to take a hand in this. And John and Dick said, you know, you got to put rock and roll in there. Everybody's getting tired of these jazz clubs around the city, and we need rock and roll. That's the coming thing. And that's basically how they decided they were going to, you know, put the style of music in there. The name was when they were all, you know, talking one evening, I think one of the potential names was the Ha Ha Club, and then a couple of other really weird names. And then one of their friends, who was a very obese guy, decided he wanted a snack and started opening up a little box of peppermints, and pops one in his mouth and says, why don't we call it the Peppermint Lounge? And that's how they got the name.
And they, in no way, shape, or form, planned for this to become what it became, the biggest dance club in New York City, patronized by celebrities like Greta Garbo, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this thing just totally blew up. And I do want to mention, before we go into the club, though, the Genovese family has showed up on many episodes of Let It Roll, probably the most involved with the music industry of any of the five families. Morris Levy, the head of Roulette Records, was the main Genovese representative. Not being Italian, he couldn't be a made man, but he was a close associate. And also, Joel mentioned Tommy Ryan Eboli, who ultimately becomes the acting boss of the Genovese family before he's murdered. And he featured heavily in our Burt Burns episode that I did with Joel. So these guys know a little bit about music, but they were not prepared for the Peppermint Lounge to become the phenomenon that it did. Futo had a contact with the founder of Decon Pesticide, Lee Ratner, and invites Lee Ratner over to the club. John, you want to tell the story of what Lee Ratner thought and what Lee Ratner did that caused things to just spiral out of control?
Well, I'll try to remember it as best I can. Yes, Johnny and Lee were pretty close, and in fact, Lee was as responsible as anybody for the wealth Johnny had accumulated. And he went there one night, I think, for just a regular meeting or some of the bookmaking and gambling things they were doing. And Lee's wife was out there watching the dancing. And all the bridge and tunnel kids from New Jersey and Connecticut were coming in, and they were doing this new dance. And his wife was fascinated. She may even have gotten up and danced, although I'm not sure about that. But Lee was taken by this too, and he contacted a guy by the name of Charlie Knickerbocker, whose real name was Cassini, the brother of Oleg Cassini, the fashion guy. And he got a notice in one of the newspapers in New York that says, you know, that all the kids are having a great time over at this described to be a chic nightclub in Times Square, the Peppermint Lounge. And it was hardly chic, but anyway, it got a lot of attention. And within a few weeks, I mean, they were having to hire, you know, I mean, they had seven or eight cop cars out front, trying to deal with the mob that was coming to this suddenly very hot little rock and roll club in New York City.
And I did things a little bit out of order. Joel, I need to backtrack and get you to tell us the story of the twist. How did it go from a B-side for Hank Ballard? Hank Ballard's been on many a Let It Roll episode, although I've never done one dedicated solely to him. But he's, you know, one of the pioneers of early 50s rock and roll when it was by Black people, for Black people. His hit had a literal foursome hit, four hit songs, the Work With Me Annie saga, which continues with Annie Has a Baby and so on, that were pretty dirty and risque. But when it was sold to jukeboxes, dirty and risque was right in the mainstream. But by the late 50s, he's kind of missed the boat on the second wave of rock and roll, the Elvis Presley, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley era that sold to white kids on the radio and on TV. How's he come up with the twist? Why wasn't it a hit? And then when it did become a hit, why didn't Hank Ballard record the hit version?
So you're so right about Hank Ballard being this incredibly important pioneer of music in the 50s. And he was extraordinarily censored. Those Hank Ballard and the Midnighter records really didn't get much radio airplay at all. As you said, they were big jukebox hits, and the audience knew the Annie records, you know, Work With Me Annie, Annie Had a Baby, Can't Work No More, and ooh, I just love those sexy ways. Those were records that the audience knew about and played on jukeboxes, but really he didn't have the career advancement of a radio hit ever. And the twist was just buried on the B-side of a pedestrian ballad. That was a record company decision. Dick Clark heard it. Now, Dick Clark was the king of rock and roll in 1959. American Bandstand was on for 3.5 hours every afternoon. He had these primetime Saturday night specials. He was just the guy who could press the button and make a record a nationwide hit. And he didn't dig Hank Ballard and the Midnighters because they were dirty as far as he was concerned. They had this reputation, as you call it, risque, but he would have said they were dirty. And it was he who suggested to Chubby Check, Ernest Evans was his real name, who was a real nice kid from Philadelphia, had had a small hit where he did impression Elvis Presley, and it was called The Class, and it was a sort of a dumb record, but he was on the scene. I guess he was about 18, 19 years old, and Dick Clark pushed the twist on him. Now, if Dick Clark says, hey, cut this song, you cut the song because, you know, he's going to play it. And if he plays it, you're going to have a hit record. It turned out to be much more than a hit. And then it went away after its initial release in 1960 with the Chubby Checker version. And then they brought back the single, the follow-up, Let's Twist Again Like We Did Last Summer, which was also a hit. And that brought back the original version of the twist in fall of 1961. And it's the only record, I think, to this day that's been a number one record twice.
Yeah, and let's go ahead and hear that. This is Let's Twist Again by Chubby Checker, the sequel to his version of the twist. And that was Let's Twist Again by Chubby Checker, the 1961 follow-up to his number one hit version of The Twist. But like you said, The Twist was a teen phenomenon in 1960. Kids who are watching American Bandstand are getting into it. Kids are dancing to it all over the country. But it's not until this chain of events that John told us about a couple minutes ago where Lee Ratner, the founder of Decon Pesticides, just happens to wander into his hooked up buddy's club, notices the kids are dancing, and the club's packed because New York is essentially starved of rock and roll clubs. So if you want to see live rock and roll in 1960-61, the Peppermint Lounge is the only place to go. They managed to hook up to their contacts in the press. It was a young Liz Smith, who later becomes, you know, the queen of the New York Post gossip column, writes a mention in the Journal American column. And pretty soon, people like Audrey Hepburn, Truman Capote, Marilyn Monroe, Julie Garland, Liberace, Noel Coward, Frank Sinatra, Norman Mailer, Annette Funicello, even Greta Garbo are in there. And this is the thing that's kind of weird to me about this. Those people were mostly in their 30s and 40s. This is not a teen phenomenon, this second round. What was the deal, Joel? What was the significance of this dance that it caught the imagination of this upscale, middle-aged crowd?
That's a good question. It is the entrance of rock and roll into sort of adult culture. That's the door they went through. And it was such a phenomenon, you can't imagine. That by the end of 1961, everybody that was in the record business was making a Twist record. I have a Lester Lannon Twist album. I mean, he was the New York Society band leader. It was just amazing. And I don't know what, you know, about it that, you know, allowed it to cross that barrier and make rock and roll something that wasn't for teenagers. What do you think, Johnny?
Well, it is a little bit vague. I think you're right about that. There was at the New York Times, there was somebody who wrote about this phenomenon. I think the quote was, "Instead of youth growing up, adults are sliding down." So, I mean, basically it shocked everybody that rather than this, just a little teen phenomenon, and especially it came out of the the black inner city area, and I think in Baltimore was where it actually began, and it certainly wasn't the first risque dance. I mean, you know, we'd had the Charleston and you'd had the Lindy Hop and all these others, but they didn't catch on with adults the way the Twist did. And I think, you know, Arthur Murray, when he was another guy who used to hang out at the Peppermint Lounge, and he said, I think that, there's no steps, it's pure swivel, and anybody can do it. That didn't mean he didn't charge charge people to teach them how to do it in six lessons.
Arthur Murray was the great legendary dance instructor who'd been going on. He took over for the Castle, who were the original teachers of the tango and the foxtrot in the teens and 20s.
That's some history, Nate.
Hey, you know, this is what I do, Joel. And
Vernon Castle, man. Now there's some names you don't reckon with too much these days.
I'm coming up soon, and their musician James Reese Europe as well. But this, and if you look into the history of it, once upon a time, it was risque when the waltz was introduced in Vienna in 1814. It was risque for a couple to dance together alone rather than as part. Originally, groups of men and women danced in lines. Then they separated out into foursomes and would do things like the square dance or the quadrille. Then they started waltzing. Then it got a little bit more up-tempo and some of the African influences came in with the foxtrot, etc. But you always had contact between the dancers, whether it's the Charleston or the Lindy Hop. Hands are being held. Arms are being hugged. But the Twist is weird because the people are standing at a remove from one another. And you guys have some great quotes in the book. I'm going to quote you back. I don't know which one of you wrote this, but that
we don't either.
Yeah, that's true.
The Twist tapped into some vital global need for self-expression in an anxious world beset by nuclear brinksmanship. Somehow the goofy dance managed to articulate a growing divide in the world, energizing people who embrace the future and threatening those who would safeguard the past. A new world was coming, and the Twist was the first tentative line drawn in the sand. And I agree with all that and think it's brilliant, but one thing I want to point out was rock and roll already had happened. You know, Elvis had exploded on the scene in 1956 nationally. really upset people. Obviously, kids loved him, sold lots of records, a lot of TV was watched to, you know, drew a lot of people, a lot of eyeballs to that Sullivan and Milton Berle show, Steve Allen show. But by 57, 58, 59, rock and roll is basically under siege. I mean, I'm not saying they shot down Buddy Holly's plane, but they might as well have. You know, they Chuck Berry's in jail. Jerry Lee Lewis is in disgrace. Little Richard's found religion and withdrawn from the scene. And you know, Alan Freed has been replaced by Dick Clark. And suddenly there's this whole generation of Brill-creamed, safe, clean, mostly Italian singers from Philadelphia and New York, guys like Fabian and Frankie Avalon and the great Dion and the Belmonts. Not all of these guys were chumps, but they were more contained. And then the twist sneaks through in this context when it seems safe and older people are interested. And to me, it kind of lays the groundwork for the Beatles by making this stuff seem like harmless fun that adults can engage in too. Either one of you want to take a shot at bouncing off that?
Let me pick up a little bit here. So yeah, rock and roll wasn't old at that point. And in fact, a lot of people had been sort of anticipating rock and roll's death for some time. 56 was the big year for rock and roll's nationwide breakthrough. That's Elvis and a lot of other records. And then 57 is Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers. And so it's really rolling. But also in 57, Harry Belafonte emerged on the scene. And there was some considerable thinking that Calypso was going to replace rock and roll as the next big thing. Now, that obviously didn't happen, although Harry Belafonte established his career. But that was the end of the Calypso boom. The twist thing happened just in an instant and was over in 6 months. It was a spike. It was some moment. And subsequent to that, people thought bossa nova might be the next big thing. Or then out from California came surf music, and that struck people as possibly the next big thing. By the time the Beatles come in, at the beginning of 1964, that debate has kind of ended. And it has become apparent that rock and roll, as they say, is here to stay.
Yes, the
twist was that the only major event in the pop music spectrum between the emergence of rock and roll and the appearance of the Beatles on these shores.
Cool. And let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the Peppermint Lounge and how the twist broke there.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
All right, now I want to talk about some of the acts that were playing at the Peppermint Lounge, because it wasn't like they had Chubby Checker there every night. Chubby Checker was busy touring the country and starring on American Bandstand. Who wants to tell me about Joey D and the Starliners, which was not quite the house band, but pretty close?
Oh, they were the house band.
Okay.
Yeah, well, they were. That was cool. They were there 5 nights a week, 6 nights a week. They've been in New Jersey. Joe Pesci was a member of them originally. But by the time they got to New York and the Peppermint Lounge, they'd settled into a kind of different lineup and they came under the tutelage, I guess you'd say, of a professional record producer by the name of Henry Glover, who came out of the Lucky Millinder Orchestra in the 40s and been the recording director at King Records for many years. Made a lot of those Hank Ballard records we were talking about, as a matter of fact.
And a lot of James Brown records, too.
No, actually, that was Ralph Bass at King Records who made the James Brown records. Glover was in charge of different, you know, he did a lot of the country records. James Brown was Ralph Bass's discovery.
Thank you for the correction. Thank you for the correction. But so we've got Henry Glover, we've got Joey D, and they're at the Peppermint Lounge. They're bringing in a crowd of, like you said, Bridge and Tunnel Kids, which is kids from Staten Island, New Jersey, Long Island, the outer boroughs. How did things change once Liz Smith's column dropped and suddenly those kids are having to share the dance floor with Audrey Hepburn? And actually, there's a great story at the beginning of the book when Dick Cammey tells how he and Fido Biello realized that suddenly they had a hot property on their hands. John, can you tell us how they found out the Peppermint Lounge had become a breakthrough club?
Well, yeah. What happened was that they were down in Florida, which Johnny was always fond of Florida, and Dick, of course, ended up settling there and opening a well-known restaurant called Top of the Home up in Fort Lauderdale area. And but anyway, they're down vacationing down there, and Dick calls up or gets a call from somebody. I think Dick was calling to check on the status of the club, because, you know, I mean, they needed to know, you know, what they used to call the mutuals, which is, you know, with the information about how the business is going. And some woman, there was no phone in the club. The nearest phone was a payphone in the Knickerbocker Hotel next door, which is led to the back door of the Peppermint Lounge, which was called the Pep by those who knew it. And this female voice answers, and he says, you know, there's probably a big, heavy guy standing near you. Could you give him the phone? And it was one of the bouncers. And one of the funny things that I always talk about this whole story is that here you have this club where the bouncers and the people at the door are all these guys who say used guys, and they were ex-wrestlers and they were mobsters. One of them was Lenny Montana, who played Luca Brasi in The Godfather. And there was also a guy named the Terrible Turk. And I think it was the Terrible Turk that got on the phone. And, you know, Dick said, what's going on there? And he said, and the Terrible Turk says, everybody's here. I mean, you know, the only guys who aren't here are you guys. And And he says, "What do you mean?" And he says, "I just saw Ava Gardner. I just saw not Ava Gardner, but Greta Garbo. I just saw Greta Garbo shaking her ass out there." And Dick says, "Greta Garbo doesn't go anywhere. You couldn't see her." And he says, "Excuse me, I'm looking right at her. It's Greta Garbo." And then he says, "You guys got to get back up here." And that's how they found out the place had really blown up. And Dick turns to Johnny and says, "I guess we ought to get back." And Johnny says, "Yeah, why don't you get the tickets?" And so then they flew back and found out what was going on.
And I love the part you tell in the book when they land, the cab driver at the airport, all they have to say is Peppermint Lounge. And he already knows exactly where it is, which is not what's been going on before with the Peppermint Lounge. It's just such a wacky story. And Joel, tell us a little bit more about how Joey D and the Starlighters and Henry Glover put together what became their big hit, the Peppermint Twist.
Well, that was Peppermint Twist. It was a custom piece of material. They had this hit club, they had this hit band. It was real simple for somebody who was a music business professional like Glover to see all it needed was a song that said Peppermint Twist in it, and bingo, they're off to the races. That was a very big record. That was also a number one hit, right on the tail of the second time Chubby Checker's Twist was number one hit. So there was like, I think, 7 weeks where there was a Twist record at the top of the charts.
Which is just incredible, and it sets up this whole feeding frenzy where everybody and their brother-in-law is doing a Twist record. We'll hear Frank Sinatra's attempt later. It reminds me of nothing so much as that period right at the end of the popular disco boom when, like, Ethel Merman is cutting disco records. Like,
yeah, I love that Ethel Merman disco record.
I'm not dissing it. I'm just that was not a development that I would have seen coming. I can remember being shocked at it as a 10-year-old. What is the deal with people like Frank Sinatra cutting a Twist record?
I'm telling you, in at the end of 1961 and the beginning of 1963, those two quarters, that's what you did. You made a Twist record. It doesn't matter who you were or that. That was what was selling. That was what was on the radio. That was what you did. Sinatra wasn't alone in doing Twist records. Nat King Cole did a Twist record. Like I said, Lester Lannon. When Lester Lannon does a Twist record, everything is upside down.
And let's go ahead and hear Joey D and the Starlighters, the Peppermint Twist.
Well, they got a new dance and it goes like this. Yeah, the name of the dance is the Peppermint Twist. Well, you like it like this, the Peppermint Twist. Bang around and around.
And that was the Peppermint Twist by Joey D and the Starlighters, the house band for the Peppermint Lounge. Went all the way to number one in the aftermath of the Twist returning to number one, Chubby Checker's version, and then Let's Twist Again going to number one right away. And you also had people like Sam Cooke had some legit artists doing legit hit Twist records. This was a phenomenon you could not get away from. But once Joey D gets big and famous, a whole bunch of other acts start emerging at the club and performing at the club. Joel, tell us, who's the biggest act that's discovered at the Peppermint Lounge?
Well, that's where the Ronettes started.
Exactly.
They were three little girls, three teenage girls that had dressed up and taken the subway down to go to the Peppermint Lounge, and they were waiting in line. And one of the doormen saw them, and they were cute. And he picked them up and pushed them into the club. And the next thing you know, they were dancing on the rail, which was on the side of the dance floor. And the club management checked them out and decided to hire them. I guess that was almost like the beginning of go-go dancers. Didn't we reckon that that was the beginning of go-go dancing, Johnny?
Yeah. It was the first time that somebody had actually gotten themselves up. And it, I mean, you know, when go-go dancers took over later on at places like the Whiskey in Los Angeles, when they would have them in, you know, thigh-high boots and in cages, it all started with Janet Huff Smith, you know, deciding to jump up on the rail in the Peppermint Lounge and do the twist.
And she was just a waitress there at the club. Yeah. So this massively culturally significant moment. I've done a whole long series on the history of disco, and they talk about go-go dancing. You know, this is, again, something we take for granted, but the idea of mostly women standing up on stage, although plenty of men had done it too, standing up on the bar or on stage or in a cage hanging from the ceiling like they did at the Whiskey Go-Go, totally unique cultural phenomenon when it happened and immediately took over the planet nationwide. And with the success, Cammy and Biello realized there's more opportunity. And like you said, they love to go to Miami. So John, tell us about the Sequel Club in Miami.
The what club? The second
sequel.
Club?
Yeah, the second.
Yeah, the Sequel.
Oh, Sequel. Well, I mean, you know, they wanted to move down there, and Johnny had it in his head that he was going to be the, I think his brother, who was known as Scatsy because he was seen as going all around the streets plugging up the manhole covers when they were making, you know, illegal hooch. You know, Scatsy said that you can never be a part-time mobster. Johnny thinks he's going to be the first. And so, you know, Johnny decides he's going to open a club down in Miami Beach, and he said he was going to let Dick run it. And at this time, they're going to be totally legit. And that's what, I mean, they got the club they opened there was three times as big. You could get several hundred people in, and it took off just as fast as the original New York club did. And so, I mean, it was an immediate hit and an immediate sensation. And I think it was Dick who painted a Volkswagen bus in the peppermint colors, you know, the red and white stripes, and drove it all around town. And I mean, it was, and of course, when the Beatles came, they had to go down there and visit the club.
That's the same weekend they met Muhammad Ali. And we'll come back to the Beatles, but I want to go back to Morris Levy, who is, you know, a recurring character on the Let It Roll show, almost always in a bad light. But this is one instance, I thought, where Morris Levy was actually a voice of responsible business practices, because he told these
yes.
What was it he told them to do with this Cutty Sark instead of what they'd been doing at the New York club?
Yeah, it was, I mean, their practice had been to water down the alcohol, and it was Scatsy who would always do it, you know, to basically save money. And the first thing that Morris Levy said is, you know, don't mess with the alcohol. He said that if a guy who knows this stuff, he will know the first time the stuff hits the back of his throat that it's not Cutty Sark, and you'll lose that guy and he'll never come back again. So they never mess with the alcohol down at the Miami club.
Yeah, I just thought that was priceless for Morris Levy to be the good angel whispering on somebody's shoulder.
Yeah.
About the way.
Absolutely. You know, Morris had a background in the nightclub business, and that goes back to his very beginnings on the scene. He was a nightclub photographer that went club to club, and then he owned and operated the biggest jazz club in New York for a long time.
Yeah, the legendary Birdland. Yeah, I'm mm-hmm. not trying completely diss Morris Levy. It's just normally when he's on this show, he's stealing somebody's royalties or taking over somebody's record company for a dollar or some gambling debts, that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of stories in there I found interesting where Dick Cammy, who's you know, from the Northeast, is having to deal with Southern segregation. Don, you want to tell us a couple of the stories where he ran into trouble with the liquor agents who were the main enforcers of Florida segregation in the early 60s?
Yeah, that was, I mean, it's so alien compared to what we think of now. I mean, even in the South, this kind of behavior wouldn't go on these days. But the liquor agents would come in and they would the first thing they would ask is, are there any, blacks in here? Only they used the epithet. And, it was okay to employ them on stage, but they couldn't come in and sit in the audience. And one time there was a family that came in to watch their son who was on stage. And I can't remember, I don't know if we even knew who the performer was, but he was on stage and the family came in and said they would like to see him. And Dick said, sure, and put him in the balcony. Then the liquor agent came in and said, and saw him and said, get those people out of here. And Dick said later it was one of the low points of his life that he had to go and kick that family out. The same agent later, when the Ronettes were down there playing, they ran off the stage and the same agent saw them and said, oh, those girls are cute. Can you fix me up with one of them? And Dick turned to him and said, let's talk in my office. And the guy went into his office and Dick gave him a forearm shiver, I think he called it, and decked him and told him never to come into the club again. And that was the end of that agent, but the one who replaced him was no better.
Yeah, I love when Dick at least gets to get a shot in there. And he had played college football, so if he gave you a forearm shiv, it was no joke. He wasn't a kidster himself, but he was definitely a man who could handle himself. Let's go ahead and hear our last song, and I just couldn't resist. I had to pick Frank Sinatra, Everybody's Twisting.
A cat who was really hep put down a step, a new gyration soon. All the kids were twisting, it didn't take long. Before the grown-ups were trying it, who's who was buying it all over town. You'll see them a-squirming and a-worming and a-twisting around. It spread like a forest blaze, became a craze that rocked the nation now. Everybody's twisting.
Everybody's Twisting by Frank Sinatra, one of his maybe two attempts to essay rock and roll. He did something called Castle Rock in the early 50s, which is more like imitating Johnny Ray, kind of proto rock and roll that was going on during the Frank's Mitch Miller years in the wilderness. But at this point, when he does Everybody's Twisting, he's got his own record label. He's at the peak of his powers. He's done, he's had his comeback. He's done From Here to Eternity, Man with the Golden Arm. He's done that great series of Capitol Records. But somehow he feels like he still has to be hip. And that's the thing, that this is just such a transitional era. And I don't remember if y'all mentioned if Bobby Darin ever played the Peppermint Lounge or not, but to me, he's like this pivotal character who goes from doing rock and roll on Atlantic Records with hits like Splish Splash, to then he suddenly does Mack the Knife and segues into what he thinks is going to be his mature adult career for lasting potentially for decades, singing the Great American Songbook, although that, of course, is a German song, not American, but in the same kind of nature thing. But that didn't last, and the twist was a big part of it. To me, this are you guys familiar with the TV series Mad Men? This is like a perfect event to fit in. I'm surprised that they didn't work in the Peppermint Lounge in a Mad Men episode, but there was something about 40-year-olds at this point that still wanted to stay cool, and Dancing the Twist was the way to do it. Little did they know that the ground is melting under their feet. And Joel, I want to get you to tell me about one of the acts that was discovered and played in the Florida Club, and I'm talking about Sam and Dave. How'd they come together, and how'd they play in the Peppermint Lounge South?
Sam and Dave were a Henry Stone thing. Henry Stone was a Florida music business guy who had his hands on Hank Ballard's Twist. As a matter of fact, it goes all the way up to the disco era when he was running TK Records. That was the origins of Sam and Dave. And since he was a Florida guy, the Peppermint Lounge was the place for them to, showcase. They didn't really become well known. And they recorded, of course. Henry sold the records to Roulette, which was more Sleevey's label. But Sam and Dave, of course, didn't come into their own until 1967 at Stax Record at Memphis, where they did with all the records with Booker T and the MGs and the Marquees and, you know, Soul Man and Hold On and Coming and all that.
Yeah, they're classic.
Sam Moore is still with us. I think he's like 83, 84 years old, lives in Arizona. He's one of the living monuments of soul music.
I'm glad to hear he's still with us and doing well. And the Ronettes had a kind of a lucky break in Florida. They meet a guy named Murray the K. Tell us about how Murray the K helped Ronnie and the Ronettes and their career progress.
Well, he was a promoter of shows. You know, the Murray the K shows at the was it the Brooklyn Fox or the Brooklyn Paramount? I can't remember. He had regular big programs of musicians, and you know that's where the Ronettes worked their way into performing in front of people.
And that's where Phil Spector saw him, I believe, and the rest is history there. But now let's tell us about the Beatles' visit to Miami in 1964. And Hank Ballard is playing at the club. John, do you want to handle this one? Or you want to let Joel tell the story of when the Beatles came to the Peppermint Lounge?
I'm fine with Joel handling it. It's
You take it, Johnny.
All right. The Beatles first came over in 64, and they were first up in New York, and they went to the club there. But when they found out that Hank Ballard was playing in the Miami club, they really wanted to meet Hank Ballard. And, you know, I mean, the Beatles did like, you know, R&B music, American R&B, and to some extent tried to copy some of the things, some of the ways that, you know, like Paul's wailing and stuff, I think, which he stole from Little Richard. But at any rate, when Dick told that the Beatles were coming, Ballard said he didn't want to meet them. At this point, Hank Ballard was kind of resentful. I mean, he'd been this very important, you know, a songwriter and made many important R&B songs. And he also recorded The Twist, but then it wasn't his that was the hit. He was sitting by a hotel pool when he first heard it and thought it was his record, but it was Chubby Checker. And so he was pretty resentful, and he said, basically, fuck them. And when they came down, you know, they were brought in, and of course the place was mobbed, and Hank is going to go away. He didn't care to meet him even then. And Dick told him, he says, you know, that's not right. These are nice kids. I've met them. And you ought to just say hello. And so finally Hank agreed. And actually they had their pictures taken with them, Hank and the Beatles. So, and even, I think Ringo even was known for getting up and doing the twist with one of the dancers called the Peppermint Twisters. And so that's basically
another part.
There's footage of the Beatles at the New York club, and you can see it. We have a trailer to the book, a video trailer, which is posted on my website, joelselvin.com. But there's a lot of footage of them, smoking cigarettes and drinking and enjoying a night at the Peppermint Lounge in New York, something they'd heard of all the way over in England. And at the time, we're all used to the Frankie Avalons and Bobby Rydells, and we never saw them smoke or drink. So seeing the Beatles smoke and drink was like, oh, wow, they're like grownups.
Similar to the way they revealed John Lennon's marriage on Ed Sullivan, which was verboten for pop singers to be married. And there's another little story about the Beatles at the club, where after they had visited, they painted the names of each of the Beatles on a chair. John, what happened when people would ask to keep one of those chairs as a souvenir?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was another funny story, is that some of these mob guys who came into the club in Miami, in fact, two guys who were there the night the Beatles were there, were, you know, they were really angry when they found the Beatles were going to be there. And one of them said, we're going to clip, you know, I'm going to clip that Ringo's hair. My girl, all she talks about is Ringo this and Ringo that. And I think it was Scatsy who said, well, do what you want with them when they leave here, but don't mess with them while they're in here. Well, that night, Dick had the idea of assigning the two mob guys to be bodyguards for the Beatles when they were sitting in the upper chairs up there in the balcony. And so they were, and one of the mob guys, while he's guarding the Beatles from all the people trying to get their autographs, would stand behind Ringo and make a scissoring motion with his hands during the set. And it turns out that one of those same guys afterwards saw one of the chairs, and he said, and on it was painted Ringo, and he says, you know, can I buy one of these, this chair from you? My kid loves the Beatles so much, and Dick knows better than to charge a mobster for something. He said, no, take it. And as soon as the guy took the chair, Dick called in a painter to paint a new chair with Ringo's name on it. And he said that there were a number of chairs like that were given away, and he didn't know why, but it was always Ringo that the mobsters wanted for their kids.
Yeah, Ringo was the one, a Beatle that kind of got individual name recognition first in America, oddly enough. I think there were Ringo for press stickers and stuff. But this, like all eras, this era has to come to an end. And I think the best way to summarize that is with the fate of Fudo Biello. John, what happened to Fudo Biello in 1967?
Well, he was assassinated. He had arrived for a meeting with Lee Ratner. It was 1967, and I think it was October. And you know, he was just business. And it would have normally been Dick was driving him in his blue Cadillac, and they parked in a parking lot. But this time it was another guy who, because Dick was, you know, preparing for a party for his family. And Johnny came out of the club, not out of the club, out of the meeting, and walked to the car. And just as he was, you know, close by, somebody ran up behind him and shot him 6 times in the back. And he was dead as soon as he hit the ground. As Johnny used to say, you know, this is the life. And it was no surprise to anybody, although, of course, his family was crushed by it. But it was... You know, he wanted to get out. He couldn't get out, just like all the others.
Yep, there's no such thing as a semi-retired mobster, like his brother tried to warn him. So the kid ends up getting sold to another mobster, Matty the Horse, Cianello, and goes through several transmutations back into a gay bar. Briefly, it's the Peppermint Lounge again. And do you know if the club's still standing?
I don't know that.
I think they tore that hotel down and put condos in.
Naturally, just like...
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yes, I remember that.
Just like all the other New York landmarks, all gone. My guess
has
been...
I don't know how valuable that real estate is, Nate.
I do. I think you got to sell something to, you know... members of the Chinese Politburo who are trying to get out
the
of town.
The Peppermint Lounge had a remarkable rebirth in the 80s, where it became the center of the sort of new wave. I wouldn't call it punk, but, you know, the experimental progressive wing of rock kind of headquartered there for a few years in the 80s. And there were a lot of, like, the bands that would have been playing at CBGB's before that played at the Peppermint Lounge.
So it had a staggeringly long run and made an enormous impact on popular culture. My guests today have been John Johnson Jr. and Joel Selvin, the co-authors with Dick Cammy of Peppermint Twist, The Mob, The Music, and the Most Famous Dance Club of the 60s, which Ronnie Spector describes as The Sopranos meets American Bandstand. Thanks so much for coming on the show, guys.
Nate, thanks for having me.
follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate welcomes Chris Duncan to kick off a Let Metal Roll mini-series with a look at thrash. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.